Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, today I get to speak with Dr. Peter Scharf, who's president of the Sanskrit Library. We'll be speaking about an important new contribution to the field. It's a collection of papers in honor of George Cardona. It's called Shabdanugamaha. Peter, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, George Cardona, who is his figure and why is he important? Maybe we can start there.
Yeah, that's a good place to start. Yeah, Professor George Cardona is the preeminent authority concerning research in Paninian grammar and one of the world's authorities concerning Indo-European linguistics. He's published a number of books and about 250 articles and reviews in this field. His book, Panini, A Survey of Research, is the place to go for anyone who starts to do research on Panini and linguistics. And he published a sequel to that. That was first published in 1976. And he published a sequel in 1990. Recent research in Paninian studies. And then his volume, Panini, His Work and Its Traditions, Background and Introduction, is the first of a series of 8 volumes he's planned that describe Paninian research and Paninian grammar. And its commentaries through the whole tradition of Paninian grammar. So this work, just the introduction itself, is a very sophisticated introduction to Paninian grammar and numbers about 800 pages in its second edition. So these three volumes so far have appeared, and he's told me that a couple of other volumes in that series are almost ready for publication. He's been working on them all his life. And he's also an authority in the field of Indo-European linguistics, historical linguistics, that is, of Indo-European languages, particularly the Indo-Aryan languages, which are basically Iranian and Sanskrit and its that is, Avestan is the oldest Iranian language known, and Sanskrit, the oldest Indic language known. And these two languages and the descendants of these make up the Indo-Aryan languages. So that's all the languages of northern India, except the Dravidian family, which make up the Indo-Aryan languages in India. And Pahlavi and Pashto are included in the Iranian side. So he published a volume, a survey of all these languages in conjunction with his former student, Dinesh Jain, called The Indo-Aryan Languages. So these are his principal books in the field. And He's well known throughout the world, including in India, and he's received the President's Award, awarded by the President of India for his work on this on Sanskrit and Vyakarana and so on.
He's obviously an important figure in the field, and perhaps at some point I should reach out for more of a conversation covering his life's work. How did this collection of papers arise? Like, what prompted this, or who decided to put together this collection in his honor?
Yeah, so he's also my teacher. So he was my dissertation supervisor at the University of Pennsylvania, where I was in graduate school from 1983 to 1990. And so I wanted to bring out such a volume in his honor for many years, but it was prompted by one of the contributors to this volume, who at one point asked him, or suggested to him, that there should be a volume in his honor. And Professor Cardona suggested to her that she contact me. And so that was Shashi Prabha Kumar, who teaches at Jawaharlal Nehru University, or is now retired from there. So Professor Cardona suggested she contact me about it, and so I undertook to put together the volumes. It turned out to be volumes. I sent out announcements on various lists asking people if they'd like to contribute to the volumes, and there are about 36 papers and 37 papers by so as many contributors, and I decided to bring out two volumes. It was too much to fit in one volume. So I divided it up into these two subjects. So the first is called Shabdanugamaha, Indian Linguistic Studies in Honor of George Cardona, volume one on Vyakarana and Shabdabodha, and volume two on historical linguistics, Vedic, etc. So the et cetera involves also archaeology, critical editing, and other aspects of Vedic literature.
There might be some in the audience who may not quite remember or not know what Vyakarana or Shabdabodha is. What are those?
So Vyakarana is the term used for traditional Indian grammar. Traditional Indian grammar in Sanskrit is called Vyakarana. And that means Panini, who lived in about the 5th century BC, and his successors, Katyayana, Patanjali, Bhartrahari, and a long tradition of commentary leading up to the present time. And many students of Sanskrit still study the works of Bhattoji Dikshita. The Siddhanta Kaumudi is part of the regular curriculum in Pathshalas, traditional schools of study in India. And Shabdabodha is what I would call cognitive linguistics, would be the modern term that comes closest to it. Shabdabodha literally means the cognition of speech, or verbal cognition. So it's what people understand when they listen, when they hear language, when they hear sentences, and how they understand what that sentence means. So the sentence has some overall meaning, but it also has an internal structure. It has a structure that, according to the grammarians and the mimamsakas in India, has the action or the meaning of the verb as its principal element, and the agent or the direct object of action are subordinate to that, and other things in the cognition subordinate to them. So it creates a very detailed structure which has been analyzed by the cognitive linguists, I would call them, of the 17th and 18th centuries, 16th, 17th, 18th centuries in India, in response to the work of Nyayakas and Mimamsakas in this area. And there's a whole discussion that takes place between these three schools and other schools as well, Buddhists and others, starting from very ancient times, even with Patanjali in the second century BC. So this tradition of discussion about what the various parts of speech mean, or what speech forms are associated with what meaning conditions, what semantic conditions, this is all worked out in Panini's grammar, but then there were discussions about it among these philosophical schools concerning what was predominant in the meaning, what was subordinate, how to interpret Panini's grammar, and so on. And these works by the grammarians in the 15th through 18th centuries really summarize the understanding of the grammatical school or the Paninian school on this issue. So there were a couple of papers, a few papers in this volume on those issues by in the various schools, one in Mimamsa, one in Nyaya, one in Vyakarana, and one in the what would be called the field of Alankara Shastra, or literary criticism. So literary criticism is also predominant. Alankara Shastra is also a predominant tradition or a discipline of study in traditional India. And this school also had their opinion about what was cognized from speech forms.
With respect to the second volume, that is as broadly on historical linguistics, could you say a bit more about what that means? Like, what is historical linguistics?
Yeah, so historical and comparative linguistics was founded in the, I would say, the late 18th century, early 19th century. The famous figure who really prompted the field is Sir William Jones, who is famous for having given a speech at the, I think it's the second or third meeting of the Asiatic Society of Bengal, where he had studied Sanskrit, and he observed that there was a similarity between Sanskrit, ancient Greek, ancient Latin, and Persian. And that he suggested that all of these languages must belong to the same language family. They must have had the same origin. And this really prompted the careful research of Franz Bopp in Germany and a number of others who followed in the 19th century to work out the science of historical and comparative linguistics. So they carefully examine the speech forms of various languages and discover what the relationships are between the phonemes in that language and trace back how an original language could have undergone regular sound changes to bring about all of the speech forms in each of the individual languages. So different languages underwent different sound changes, and the structure of their phonemic system evolved gradually through people's usage, ordinary usage in those languages, to bring about the modern languages. So one can determine that languages are familially related in this way. And familial relationship is just one relation among languages. So I mentioned that, you know, most of the languages of India, that is all of the languages of the Indo-Aryan family, the Indic languages descended from Sanskrit, are in that family, but it differs from the family of the Dravidian languages. The Dravidian languages, meaning Tamil, Malayalam, Telugu, Kannada, and Tulu. These languages from the Dravidian family, but they also share a great deal with Sanskrit. So there's been a lot of tension in India over this issue about the Aryan languages versus the Dravidian languages and so forth. But the Dravidian languages also have a close relationship with Sanskrit because they're intertwined with the tradition for 3,000 years now. And so the Dravidian languages have huge borrowings from Sanskrit and some borrowings also in the reverse direction. Sanskrit also borrowed some from the Dravidian languages. So the vocabulary in Dravidian languages is more than 50% derived from Sanskrit. So borrowing vocabulary is a different thing from familial relationship because there are many other features involved besides vocabulary in a language, but other features also get borrowed. So some syntactic influence from Dravidian also appears in Sanskrit. Some phonetic influences like retroflexion of consonants is borrowed from Dravidian in Sanskrit. And so there's an intertwining of these language families in the area, and this is called the aerial effects of language influence, which is also a part of the study of historical and comparative linguistics. So there's what's called a genetic relationship, but you know the genetic relationship in languages is just an analogy to genetics, because in genetics, you inherit your DNA from your parents, but the relationship in linguistics is not quite so definitive. Okay, there are a lot of inherited features, but there are many features which come from other languages through contact. And those contact features are called aerial effects or substratum effects. Sometimes they're called, depending on the relationship between the languages. So there's a very close relationship between the Dravidian family and the Aryan family in India as well. So for example, Malayalam has about 80% of its vocabulary derived from Sanskrit. And what's interesting is even the advocates of Tamil nationalism and independence for Tamil Nadu and so forth, and such highly volatile and controversial political movements, even they have names which are derived from Sanskrit, ironically.
Hey, it's perhaps it's worth saying aloud that on this podcast we engage all sorts of ideas in a respectful manner, and it is my hope certainly that those who are listening, who may be heritage learners, understand that scholars at the Western Academy, in my personal experience, by and large, have great respect for Indic civilizations and are sort of burning the midnight oil in hopes of clarifying historical and linguistic processes. So this, you make an important point about when we talk about the genetics, the heritage of languages, that it's only an analogy to, it's not a direct analogy to genetics in its proper sense, insofar as in terms of bloodlines or genes, it's a vamsha, it's a lineage, there's a line to be traced. Whereas with respect to genetics, it's more of a web where there are where there's much more cross-pollination sort of back and forth. Would you agree with that?
No, actually, I would say there's cross-pollination in genetics, in the field of linguistics, there's much more variability than in genetics. It's not as clear a lineage, okay? Because there's lots of borrowing from contact. It's a social phenomenon. Language is a social phenomenon. It's not a biological phenomenon. So the analogy it's just an analogy to genetics when we talk about parent languages and daughter languages and so forth. they're not really daughters, right? There's no genetic relationship there.
So what I was saying is that idea of lineage or line or relationship that occurs in genetics, but that doesn't really occur directly in linguistics because it's of a web. It's a web of associations.
That's right. I thought you said the opposite. It sounded.
Oh, like no.
It's much more of a web in the field of linguistics than it is in the field of biology.
And also, it seems to me that while these questions are important, you know, separating out, you know, what came from where. Currently, we have Japanese cars or German cars. Well, to say, well, no, the car was invented in America, right? And then, et cetera. Currently, we have the fabric of culture that's been impacted by various traditions, and it doesn't make it any more or less Hindu or Indic, whether it's primarily from Dravidian heritage or a Sanskritic heritage or both or neither. So it's sort of complex to try to separate out what came from where in this kind of linear fashion.
It is. And sometimes the attributions of linear development are misleading or incorrect. So you mentioned the car. So the motor automobile, right? The motor-driven automobile was invented in America, but it was just a small, advance or modification of the steam engine, which was invented in England, and of course the horse-drawn vehicles or ox-drawn vehicles were around for thousands of years. So they were also called cars, in a sense, chariots. The word chariot is related to the word car. And these were around for thousands of years. So it's a small development is added onto the top. The car wasn't invented out of nothing, right? It was a small modification to replace the steam engine with an engine that burned carbon fuel. Okay, so that was a modification, and that runs independently, a small vehicle compared to a train, which drags along, you know, a long series of cars behind it. Indeed. So in the same way, inventions in linguistics have a history. So I mentioned that historical linguistics was invented in Europe. However, the histories of linguistics, most histories of linguistics, trace the history of linguistics from the Greeks through the Romans to medieval Europe, and then they see as a sort of branch and so forth. I wrote an article myself contributing to a volume on the Handbook of Historical Linguistics traced the history of linguistics in this way and talked about the contribution of India to the field as under the heading of pre-grammar. Now this in my opinion, and I wrote to the editor about this, is an insult. And it's
laughable in the face of Panini.
It's both laughable and an insult because in fact, the Indian tradition has contributed not just to grammar, and it can hardly be called pre-grammar. It's also contributed to the science of phonetics, to the science of syntax, you know, to all branches, semantics, to all branches of linguistics. To just say that it's pre-grammar is ridiculous. And I said, there should be a contribution in each of these areas in your volume, not just one on pre-grammar. But he insisted that that was the way the volume was going to be. But what I would do, and what histories of Indian linguistics have done, is they recognize that actually the primary sequence in the development of linguistics is from India, because India had an extremely sophisticated science of phonetics, semantics, and grammar in the early centuries BC, you know, starting with Shakalya's analysis of the Rig Veda into the Padapata and the development of the Pratishakyas, the science of Nirukta, which was sometimes called etymology. But these sciences are really the beginning of a science of language that was not matched in the West. And Paninian grammar, the sophistication of Paninian grammar, was the direct inspiration for the sound laws that were invented in the 18th century, late 18th century, early 17th century, that founded historical and comparative linguistics. So it's Panini's sound laws, which track what's called sundhi, or the phonetic changes that take place within words or between morphemes within words and between words. They borrowed this concept from Panini and applied it in a historical way, in a temporal way, looking at many languages together. So it was an innovation, but it was an innovation closely based on and inspired directly by the knowledge of Sanskrit and Paninian grammar by these scholars in Europe in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Fascinating for so many reasons. So these volumes, how do I phrase this? Who might be interested in them? Like, who might most benefit from reading the articles in this volume? And let me give you an example of what I mean. So one of my interests, as many of the listeners may know, I'm technically a Sanskrit, a scholar of Sanskrit narrative, Puranas and the epics, but neither here nor there for the podcast, really. But my master's work was on the Valmiki Ramayana, and it's a work that I return to every now and then. It still fascinates me. There's a fascinating paper in the second volume by Robert Goldman on the poetics of the Valmiki Ramayana, and I certainly may not necessarily have known to look to this volume for research on the Valmiki Ramayana. So could you give us a sense of who might most benefit from this volume?
Yeah, okay. So yeah, obviously, let me just say a word about the first volume. You know, the first volume, it's a narrower area. It covers a narrower area, the Vyakarana and Shabdabodha, that is the grammar and cognitive linguistics in the Indian tradition. And so people who are in the field of studying, scholars studying Sanskrit grammar or Alankara Shastra, Nyaya and Mimamsa may be interested in this volume. In particular, though, there are some papers in there which are extremely important. So one, the first volume in the first, the first paper in the first volume, it describes the discovery of a manuscript at Harvard University, where I was managing a project to catalog the approximately 2,000 manuscripts at Harvard University. We created a descriptive catalog, a digital descriptive catalog of all of these manuscripts. And we stumbled across this one manuscript, which was on the, it's a text which shows the variant readings in the Paninian Sutrapada. And so this shows about twice as many readings, variant readings, as had been previously documented by Kielhorn. And so is crucial even for the very base text of the Ashtadhyayi. So, you know, all these students who are studying Vyakarana in traditional Pathshalas are learning a certain text of the Ashtadhyayi, which may not be the original text of the Ashtadhyayi, and they're not aware of this history. So this is an important, particularly important paper. It's the text is called the Nagesha Paryalochit Bhashya Sammata Ashtadhyayi Sutrapata, Ashtadhyayi Pata. Nagesha Paryalochita Bhashya Sammata Ashtadhyayi Pata. That is the recitation of the text of the Ashtadhyayi accepted in the Mahabhashya as examined by Nagesha. And so this text looks at Nagesha's comments on the Mahabhashya and determines what are the correct readings according to him. And it mentions all the variants that he discusses. So it's an extremely important paper for the whole history of Sanskrit grammar. And then there are, you know, about half a dozen other papers which deal with Paninian derivation in various ways. One that I wrote deals with how Panini uses what we would call future conditions. You know, that people tend to want to construct derivations of Paninian grammar in a certain order, but sometimes that order has to anticipate the application of a rule which is applied later in the derivation. I call these future conditions. And they're justified because they're justified on the grounds that actually Paninian grammar is describing language and that grammar exists in a way in sort of the mental understanding of all of the speakers of the language. And so it's a static phenomenon. And it's not like we're creating something the way a potter creates a pot. We're reconstructing artificially the language that already exists. And because it already exists, there's no real question of primary, prior and latter. It's just a artificial procedure. And so you can have what are called these future conditions. And so there's that discussion and similar papers which deal with interesting issues of the derivation, sequence of derivation, of the validity of certain principles that are used in Paninian grammar, of what is understood by putting items in sequence with each other, whether the rules really mean them to be an immediate sequence or there's can have something in between two items in a sequence. Certain terms in the formation of compounds like shesha, which means remainder. What is the remainder in a certain rule of forming compounds that describes what are called bahuvrihi compounds? Bahuvrihi compounds are described as being the remainder with respect to the other categories of compounds which are described. And what is the universe within its a remainder? All these kinds of questions are dealt with. They're technical questions of Paninian grammar, but they're very important questions. And one question was dealt with by Aleix Ruiz Falquez on the optionality, that is options in the grammar that are recognized in the grammar according to Kachayana Vyakarana, which is a Pali grammar. Okay. And this is relevant even to Sanskrit grammar because there's a question about what the three terms concerning options in Paninian grammar mean. That is va, vibhasha, and anyatarasyam all have been interpreted in the Paninian tradition as being uniform in meaning. But a famous American scholar of Sanskrit grammar, Paul Kiparsky, had proposed that these terms designate a sort of variation, and he terms Panini a variationist, meaning that these mean different percentages of the frequency of usage in the language. And so this scholar, Aleix Ruiz Falquez, takes up the question because it looks like in the Pali grammar, there's some recognition of some difference in meaning among these terms. So that question and his analysis has some relevance to this discussion in Paninian grammar. And so then there's also a paper there by a Japanese scholar, Ozono, this is a family name, about about what constitutes correct speech. And he reviews topics brought up in the Paspashatnika of the Mahabhashya and traces their source in, very carefully traces the source of those arguments in earlier texts, citations from the Rig Veda and other Brahmanas and so forth. And he concludes that actually Patanjali recognized a sort of realizing power of speech, not just a flat language science, but that speech itself has the power to realize something in our lives. It creates something. And this creative power of speech is something that is dealt with in some of the other texts in the second volume. So, for example, the work by the scholar I mentioned, Shashi Prabha Kumar, talks about the realizing power of speech in the very famous Vak Sutta, that is Rig Veda 10.125, which talks about the power of speech to create the entire universe. So this kind of realizing power of speech is an important concept in the Indian tradition. But that second volume has a number of important papers which are of more general interest, I think, to any Indians who are, even the Indian public, not necessarily scholars, because they deal with topics which are of important contemporary interest, sort of political or sociological issues. So Asko Parpola, for example, very carefully in a long paper summarizes all the evidence from archaeology and linguistics together that detail the history of Proto-Indo-European into Proto-Iranian, into Vedic and Avestan, into Middle Indic and so on, and particularly locates what is the source at various stages in the development of Proto-Indo-European to Sanskrit. And that's very interesting scholarships to summarize, because this has been such a hot political issue in India, which is unfortunately not well understood, and many people make it more of a political issue than it should be. It's really an issue of science, and it should be approached in that sense. We want to find out what the truth is about this, and we don't want to rely on just political banter one way or the other. But the evidence he summarizes is very important for the question. Another very important paper is by George Dunkel, who looks at the Sarvanukramani. The Sarvanukramani is an ancient text written in the several centuries BC, which describes the authorship, among other things. Sarvanukramani means not only the authorship, but also what the principal topic or the deity to whom a hymn may be dedicated, as well as the meter of the hymn. And these things all collected together were listed in various anukramanis separately, but the Sarvanukramani talks about all of them. And in the Sarvanukramani, then certain authorship is attributed to, and certain hymns are attributed to certain authors. And in his careful analysis of the linguistic features of the Vedic hymns, he discovers that there are distinctive linguistic features that belong to the hymns which are attributed to various families. In other words, the so-called family books of the Rig Veda, and the same hymns which are in the non-family books, that is in the first, ninth, and tenth mandalas, and parts of the eighth mandala, which do not belong to the specific family. All these hymns, which are attributed to specific families, share distinctive features which verify and validate the attributions of these hymns to particular authors in the Sarvanukramani. Now, there are There's a scholar in the late 19th century who denigrated the Sarvan Ukramini, saying that it was just fanciful. The attribution of hymns to certain authors was fanciful. And this validation of that attribution is very important. It validates and verifies the importance of the Sarvan Ukramini for these attributions. Another important paper by Hans Hawk discusses the syntax of Tattvamasi. Now, Tattvamasi, as you know, is one of the Mahavakyas and incredibly important in the science of Vedanta in India, which for thousands of years was understood to mean literally that thou art, or you are that. And the that there is understood to refer to Brahman, that is the absolute, unbounded Satchidananda, the existence, consciousness, bliss, okay, absolute consciousness. And the identification, you are that, is the realization, recognizes the realization on the part of Shvetaketu in Chandogya Upanishad, I think it's the Chandogya Upanishad, where he recognizes him as having reached the state of recognizing that his individual consciousness, subjective consciousness, is the same or identical with the absolute consciousness, which is the source of the whole universe. And this important concept of Advaita Vedanta has been understood to be summarized in this sentence, Tattvamasi. Now, about 20 years ago, there was an article by a rather famous, rather well-known and competent Western scholar who said that the tat here can't be a pronoun. It has to be understood adverbially. And he would translate it rather, you are like that, or you are in that way. And this translation was then used by another well-known American scholar, he's actually originally from Sri Lanka, who put out a translation of the Upanishads along with his edition of the Upanishads. And he translated it accordingly, that you are in that way. But so 20 years this has survived, and it was even mentioned again by a third scholar, third rather well-known English scholar, who upheld this as one of the important contributions of recent American scholarship to the understanding of Sanskrit. Now, the whole Indian tradition and most modern Indian scholars, including others like myself, balked at such an interpretation as ridiculous. But Hans Hawk undertook the careful syntactic research to demonstrate that this modern interpretation of the phrase was false and upheld the traditional interpretation that tattvamasi does actually mean you are that, and that there is a pronoun and not a pronominal adverb. So this is important to rectify the misunderstanding that has been current and copied in modern Western scholarship.
Fascinating. Now, what I'd like to do before we close for today is tell us a little bit about the Sanskrit Library that you're the president of. And as you talk about it, maybe make mention of some of the educational opportunities through that platform.
Yeah, okay. Before we turn to that, let me just mention one other paper, which I think is important for...
Sure.
Actually, there are a couple of... One is by Lauren Bausch, a scholar in California in the United States, who worked on the concept of caste. Now, caste is a really hot topic in modern India today. And And it's a point of contention. And the whole idea of racism is such a hot political topic today that I think this is worth mentioning. And her research showed that there are a number of discussions in ancient texts which show that varna can be a concept which is looser than genetics. Okay, so there are texts which show that certain individuals belong to more than one varna at a time. That is, someone can be both a Brahmin and a Kshatriya at the same time. And so the concept, she says, has to be understood, at least in some contexts, as referring to capacities or powers or roles of an individual, rather than to strict and rigid racial classes. And this is important, and it's something that everyone, both on the right and left of this issue, should understand, that in ancient India, the concept of class, at least in some texts, was understood to be having capacities or roles in society. And so that's one paper which I think would be of general interest to people. And one other, which I just want to mention briefly, is Edwin Giraud, a senior scholar of Sanskrit poetics, talks about figures of speech in the Natya Shastra. And the Natya Shastra has sometimes been criticized as having a rather minimal description of figures of speech. It only describes four figures of speech. And what he points out is that Bharata's Natya Shastra is not dealing with individual figures of speech. It's making a typological classification. And so it's not guilty of the lack of sophistication, which sometimes has been attributed to it. It actually is much more sophisticated. So that's an interesting article for people in the field of poetics or dramatics to look at.
Indeed.
So now, you'd like to turn to some more general topics, and you mentioned the Sanskrit library. I founded the Sanskrit library in 2002. It's a digital library of Sanskrit texts, lexical resources, and other linguistic resources that can connect the lexicons with the texts. And the idea is to allow the public, that is the public who has some interest in Sanskrit and knows some Sanskrit, because all of the things on our site are in Sanskrit. We don't have translations, and we don't have PDFs of texts. And PDFs of texts are available from archive.org and other sites. And many sites, there are many websites today which make texts available, but most of these texts that are made available are just available as texts to read, and that's all you can do with them there. Occasionally some websites interconnect texts in an interesting way, but what we do on our site is try to connect the text with the lexicons and the linguistic resources to allow scholars of Sanskrit to understand the texts themselves, the original texts. So what we did was we digitized in conjunction with Thomas Malton at the University of Cologne, 45 lexical resources, that is all of the major lexical resources, Sanskrit to English dictionaries, Sanskrit monolinguistic dictionaries like the Shabdakalpadruma and the Vachaspatya, and the great Sanskrit-German lexicon of Bötlink and Roth. We digitized all these sources, and with the Moni Williams, and we integrate them in a single interface. So one can look up a word and then click on the various dictionaries to see how it's defined in these different resources. And this is very important because we've included some specialized dictionaries as well as its lexicon, which many people don't use because they're just too hard to access. Even if a scholar has these in his own private library, he would hesitate to get up out of his chair and pull the book off the shelf in order to look it up in these several different sources. Whereas here we have it readily available just by clicking on a single click. You can bring the same word up in this specialized dictionary. So this allows greater access to greater detail with greater ease. And so we hope to improve the scholarship by giving people access to these various resources. And we've also connected them to the texts. So one is reading a text, one can click on a word in the Sunday analyzed version of the text, that is the text in which the phonetic changes between words have been analyzed and the word appears in its standalone form, as in a padapata. One can click on that word and get a morphological analysis of the word. One may have to choose between more than one morphological analysis, which may be possible, and then click on the stem and it will immediately lead one to the dictionary where one can get the definition. So this integrates the dictionaries with the text in a way that makes them extremely easy to access and may help and improve and ease the scholarship on languages and the understanding of texts. And this may be useful even for the lay reader. So it's very much a work in progress, our website. It has a number of features which are good and easy to access. It also has some kinks here and there, which we're still working out, and we're understaffed. We need help. We need funds to be able to hire help. And we're trying to build this website over now 20 years, and still have a lot to go to improve it and increase the number of texts on the site. But that's our ideal, is to have all the text access in a way that allows immediate access to the linguistic features and meanings of the text.
The URL for the Sanskrit Library is sanskritlibrary.org. It will be also included in the podcast notes for this episode. Before you close, why don't you say a little bit about online education through the Sanskrit Library, the types of offerings you have, and really how did this come up? Because in a couple of our conversations on the podcast, we've been noting the burgeoning field of online education, and COVID's just solidified and crystallized that for many of us. So tell us a little bit about that aspect of the library, please.
Yes, and that was actually the impetus for us as well. When everyone was locked in their homes, we decided to go online with Sanskrit education. Of course, I've been teaching Sanskrit for 30 years now, 20 years at Brown University and 10 years at various Indian institutions since then. But when we were not able to meet in person, we decided to start offering classes online. So Tanuja Ajotikar and I both offer classes through the Sanskrit Library, and now we've begun to include some others as well. Prasad Bide in Bombay has just offered a very interesting course on Natya Shastra. And so these courses are available online at the Sanskrit Library under courses on the Sanskrit Library webpage, where we describe two categories of courses. There are some courses which are meant to be equivalent to university courses, as in the United States and in Europe and elsewhere at Indian universities. They're equivalent to undergraduate or graduate courses of one semester each. We offer, for example, introductory Sanskrit, and in 1 year we would cover all the basics that are meant to be covered by a 1 year graduate course for students who are going into graduate school. And we also offer continuing education courses, which are mostly 10 lesson courses, 1 hour a week for 10 weeks, for example. and they're meant for the general public and don't have any homework, but they're meant to introduce various topics of interest to the general public. And they range from things like the Nati Shastra to of course, introducing Paninian grammar. And we have descriptions of all these courses online. One that we wanted to offer to the general public, particularly during the COVID time, was traditional Indian health maintenance and essential Ayurvedic practice through its sources. This course was meant to introduce to people the traditional daily routines that should be performed by everyone to enhance their health and the basic understanding of Ayurveda for our health. Another is an introduction to the Rig Veda. I mentioned the introduction to the Paninian tradition. And one, we have a course on the retelling of Rama's story in Sanskrit literature, looking at how the story of Rama is told in not only in the Valmiki Ramayana as a Upakhyana in the Mahabharata, but in numerous other texts, such as the Ananda Ramayana and some 25, 35 other Sanskrit sources. And this course on Sanskrit theater, I haven't yet offered it, but I have on the website a description of a course I intend to offer on concepts of the self in classical Indian philosophy, creation mythology and enlightenment in the Indian tradition, and Vedic philosophy of language. So these are the courses we have now available. And we also offer what we call pundit training courses. Tanuja is a traditionally trained Sanskrit scholar through a traditional education group in Pune. And so she offers courses which are based on that kind of instruction, very detailed and careful instruction of Sanskrit texts and their commentaries, including general courses in literature, but also specifically in Sanskrit Vyakarana, so reading the Siddhanta Kaumudi, for example.
That looks great, actually. I'm really glad to know of this development. I tend to be a bit of a hub in terms of Hindu studies online education between teaching at the OCHS, continuing studies, and a number of other platforms. And now that I know that these courses exist, I may well send students over who would be interested in these topics.
Wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
And yeah, thank you very much. And I'm so delighted you contact me. And I'm always doing everything I can to bring Sanskrit knowledge to the public awareness. And I really appreciate your helping me do that.
Excellent. For those of you listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Peter Scharf, who is the president of the Sanskrit Library. The link is in the podcast notes. We've been speaking about, among other things, this really important couple of volumes on Indian linguistic studies in honor of George Cardona. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, and keep contemplating the importance of Sanskrit. Take care.
Let me mention one other thing before you close, that the link to these publications is available on the Sanskrit Library website under publications, where there are some links that give descriptions of all the contributors to the volumes and the table of contents, and also a link to the press where one can order the books.
Excellent. All right. Take care.
Thank you again.